Earlier in the year, the GIPC, the General Insurance Practice Committee, called for expressions of interest in a paper on the setting of discount rates for general insurance premiums. A very simple question. The winning team consisted of these people here, Peter and Hugh. That's Peter and Tim and who are you? And Brett and Hugh. And the inside two are from... who are you from? From Finley, and the outside two are from Taylor Fry. That's the introduction for them. I'd like to invite Peter to start and give the.
No, I'm starting.
You're starting, are you? Okay, all right. Brett to start and see what I have to say.
We mixed the order up to confuse you.
Yeah, you did.
Okay, thank you, David, and hello, everyone. We've been ambitious. We've got a lot of slides to cover in a short space of time, so we're going to motor through them pretty quickly. There is a draft paper on the website, so please read it and have a look. We'd welcome your feedback. Maybe I'm biased. I think this slot looked, even though it's a graveyard slot just after lunch, it is often a difficult one, but it looked like there were a few good sessions, so thanks for coming to ours. Some of you may have noticed my other half's actually presenting at one of the other sessions, so I'm disappointed some of you didn't go and try and heckle her. We know this matters particularly for long-tail classes because of the gap. You know, the typical insurance arrangement is you collect a premium, sometime later you pay a claim. So however you look at it, whether it's you treat it as a discount rate or an investment earning assumption, it matters. What do we mean by discount rates? Anything that involves that time value of money, so whether it's a best estimate of projected investment income, risk-free rates, a return on equity, or some risk-adjusted discounted cash flow. We've looked at all those depending on the pricing model and what your objective is. The topic seems to be uncontroversial, but we have had some strong feedback from different parties, quite diametrically opposed in some places, so we hope to hear your views and hopefully there's enough time for a bit of discussion afterwards. We've tried to describe the range of methods used. We're not necessarily advocating every method discussed in the paper. The objective was to provide some practical guidance on approaches which are intuitive, easy to implement, inexpensive and flexible, with a sound theoretical footing. And one thing we've tried to address from the commission was something that was also useful for students and people new to the area. After I set out the reasons for the paper, summarise the findings and a bit of background, Peter will describe the two pricing models that we've considered in a bit of detail and the issues around setting their discount rate assumptions. Tim will then describe a couple of real-world examples that we developed for CTP and motor, so one long, one short tail. And then Hugh will discuss some work we've done around yield curve projections, which I guess is the new thing. You'll hear that not a lot from what we've seen has changed in the last 20-odd years. Thanks to Dave and the other reviewers for looking at the paper, and thanks to the Institute for providing the grant to support the research. So why did a few people from Finley and Taylor Fry agree to do the paper together? David's told you about the motivation from GIPC and the Research Council committee. The main motivation was the challenges in yield curve projection and that delay from when you set rates to when the rates are implemented and the different approaches that are followed in practice. Many use the forward rate, and we wanted to test whether that is the best approach. And that delay and that fixing of a rate is mandated or strongly encouraged in certain spaces, particularly regulated classes like CTP. Discount rates aren't always a key input. Obviously, short-tail classes, it doesn't matter as much. Other inputs are often challenging. For example, getting a good estimate of the technical claims cost. There are long-established techniques, and we'll find in some classes that the market price often matters more than technical price, so it's only a guide. And one other observation is, as we heard in the plenary yesterday, there are a lot of challenges in general insurance at the moment. Interest rates are low and are expected to remain low for some time. In theory, all else being equal, that should lead to higher premiums. In a competitive market, that's not always the case. So getting some extra yield or at least minimising any risk about getting it wrong between that gap between setting rates and implementing them is more important, or as important now as ever. Very quickly, I'll go through our key findings, and you'll hear more about these from the guys. The two models we considered were the internal rate of return model, which would be well known to many of you, and Myers-Cohen, and the discount rates that each of those use. A key finding was a negative relationship between the risk-free rate and the equity risk premium. So that sort of lends itself to some stability when you set a CAPM-based estimate of a risk-adjusted rate. Setting the two in isolation can cause some trouble. Understanding the relationship between return on equity and targeted shareholder return is important, and understanding those two concepts. Return on equity, the idea there is the profit the insurer generates as a percentage of its net assets, so it's very accounting-focused. Target shareholder return is more a financial economics concept, looking at the value of the company, the market cap, if you like. One of the papers we refer to covers that in some good detail. Just a word of warning about being careful deriving a ground-up return on equity estimate. If you take an approach that looks at assets and liabilities and the risks of those and how they come together, if you don't take into account all the frictions and real-world complications, that can give misleading estimates. Myers Cohen, as we know, a lot of people do have some issues with that. It's contentious. We talk a bit about the framework and say, yes, there are some limitations in terms of how it has been applied in the past, but it is a framework that can be used if you adapt it to allow for certain frictions. It's just, I guess, debatable which ones of those people want to allow for. We'll hear from Hugh about the yield projection. Key finding was that across the cycle, so all yield curve shapes, normal, inverted, flat curves, if you use today's spot curve or a forward rate derived from today's spot curve, they don't tend to perform too differently, but it depends on the situation. So if you're starting at the date that you set your rates with a very steep, normally sloped yield curve, the spot tends to perform better on average. The forward rate does tend to overestimate what the risk-free rate will look like in 6 months' time. Hugh will describe the formula that he's developed, which is a further improvement on that approach. Testing, playing around with our internal rate of return model, we found that the measured return on equity can vary by between 0.5% and 1% if you use spot rates versus a single discount rate, a single interest rate. So I guess the finding there was just be careful using your models. And we also tested the impact of shifting investments from what I call an industry average mix to a replicating portfolio. So one which is already low risk, mostly in cash and fixed interest, but with a bit of high-grade credit exposure, maybe a little bit of mismatching. If we shifted that to a fully replicating Commonwealth Government index-linked portfolio, we estimated that the asset risk charge would reduce from about 2.8% of those assets to nil, because it's a hypothetical, theoretical, perfect construct. We estimated in our assumptions that the investment return would drop by about 0.5%, and most of that being sort of a credit spread. Capital would fall as a result because your PCR's dropped, but the return on equity would drop by somewhere between 0.5% and 1%. So those are the sorts of trade-offs. Very quickly on background, there's been no major advances in this space that we've found in the last 20, 25 years. The paper talks a bit about some of those, and the academic literature, some of the extensions of these two basic models, particularly around things like building in option pricing techniques. The distinction between regulated and unregulated classes is important, because obviously there are considerations of what is a fair premium in the regulated space, whereas in unregulated markets, it really is a case of you derive what you think is a good, sound estimate of the technical price, but ultimately it's a question of what the market will allow you to charge. And with that, I'll hand over to Peter.
Thanks, Brett. Okay, so Brett's given a brief introduction to, I guess, the motivation for this paper and the background to this paper. In the next six slides, I'm hoping to give a very quick overview of the two main pricing models used in general insurance, the internal rate of return model and the Myers-Cohen model, and then a brief discussion about considerations in terms of determining the discount rates in those two models. Now, it's going to be very quick, so if you want more detail, please have a look at our paper. And also, I guess for me, the new thing about this work is actually going to be presented at the end of this talk, so I don't want to take away from that. We've had a bit of a delay to our start today, so I'll move very quickly. So first of the models is the internal rate of return model. That should be known to most actuaries as part of the professional, the GI course. So the idea here is you start with all the cash flows in terms of writing a line of business, and they're shown in that diagram on the left. And then we discount those cash flows using a single discount rate called the return of equity, the return on equity. And that discount rate's meant to account for the time value of money and also the overall riskiness of the cash flow. So it kind of captures the average riskiness of all those cash flows. And we then choose a premium that sets the net present value of those cash flows to zero. So that's the standard model. So it's a well understood model. When you're projecting the components of the different cash flows, it's well understood that expected values are used for those cash flows. But there are some questions about the application of the method. One is about how you choose a return on equity, and I'll get to that in a moment. But another one is around the concept of franchise value and intangible assets. So in the paper, we refer to franchise value as a difference between, I guess, the market value of the company and the value of its tangible assets or its net assets. So that's the difference between those two. So very loosely speaking, that difference can be thought of as the value of the intangible assets of the company. And there are two ways you can allow for those in this type of model. One way is that you can just increase your asset base. So you can increase your asset base for those intangible assets. Another way, and I think it's a preferred way, is to start to work with a return on equity. So return on equity, where you're defining your equity as your tangible assets. But then you, I guess, load that return on equity so that we get the required total shareholder return. So that's trying to get the returns that you want on the market value of the company. So that's just a small distinction, and it's one way of dealing with franchise value and intangibles. So the Myers-Cohn is another discounted cash flow model, probably the only one that's actually used in practice, but it's not used very often. It's occasionally used in regulated markets trying to come up with fair premiums, so premiums that a regulator can justify. But it's fair to say that its use is waning, and we've included it, I think, because by understanding it, you get a better appreciation of the issues in discounted cash flow models. So it starts with exactly the same cash flows as the internal rate of return model, and in the same way, you choose a premium which sets the net present value of those cash flows to zero. But where it's different is that instead of having a single discount rate, you have many discount rates. So each of the different types of cash flow are discounted with their own discount rate. So, for example, the claims and expenses cash flows are discounted with what's called a return on liability discount rate. Investment returns we discounted at the return on assets, and taxes tend to be they're a bit more complicated, but they'll depend on the return on liabilities and usually the risk-free rate. So quite similar in terms of cash flow constructs, but a little bit different in effect. So in practice, internal rate of return is preferred, and usually for practical reasons. And the first reason it's preferred is around the underlying assumptions. And that's more to do with the assumptions used to set the discount rate. So when Myers-Cohn is traditionally used, it's used using a capital asset pricing model, so the CAPM model. And one of the consequences of using CAPM in the Myers-Cohn context is that you end up with premiums that you'd expect in a perfectly competitive market, a freely competitive market. So many practitioners think, well, the real world, there's frictions that needed to be allowed for, imperfections, therefore we shouldn't really look at Myers-Cohn premiums. Or if we do, they're just a starting point and they'll need it to be loaded up for the real world frictions. Another reason internal rate of return models are preferred is around practicality. It's the main discount rate in internal rate of return models is the return on equity. That's something that I'll talk about a little bit later, but you can get objective measures of return on equity by looking at stock price movement. So you can get an asset model, might be the CAPM, might be another multi-factor model, and you can get objective estimates of return on equity. While in Myers-Cohen, the main discount rate is the return on liabilities. Liabilities aren't traded in an open market, so it's very hard to get objective measures of that return on liability. And probably the last advantage of internal rate of return is just by focusing on the return on equity, it's something that management understands, they're familiar with hurdle rates, so it's got that ease of interpretation. The one advantage of Myers-Cohen is that by considering individual cash flows and the riskiness of those cash flows, it's kind of a risk accounting, and that can be useful in some contexts, and that's why it's useful to consider. But in the following two slides on assumption setting, I'm going to focus on the internal rate of return because that's all we have time for. Now, in the internal rate of return, I've talked about the main discount rate being the return on equity, but risk-free rates do play a role in the model, but only indirectly, and that's in when we make forecasts of the cash flows. Some of those cash flows are shareholder capital, and that's going to depend on, I guess, capital requirements for the company, which will also depend on the discounted values of liabilities. So the risk-free rates play a role in those, determining the discounted rate, value of those liabilities. And for reasons of time, I'll skip over it, but most people are going to do their valuations under an APRA basis. Commonwealth government bonds are mandated by APRA. There's good reasons for that. So there's not much controversy about the risk-free rate for the internal rate of return model. The return on equity is more interesting. And I guess the approach that can be taken probably depends on whether you're dealing with an unregulated class or a regulated class. So if you've got a regulated class, at least the regulator needs to justify the rates that are being charged or the internal rate of return a little bit more. So in unregulated classes, the return on equity can be set to whatever the company chooses it to be. You're really only limited by market reality, so that's the main constraint. But in reality, they'll be set at some hurdle rate, and that hurdle rate will be set so that the company achieves a required total shareholder return. So there's not much more to it than that. So for regulated classes, you'll be basing those return on equities probably on an asset pricing model. So the capital asset pricing model is one possible model. There are other factor models, like the Farmer-French three-factor model is another one that could be used. But in regulated industries in general, the CAPM tends to be the favoured one, mainly because it's easier to parameterise and well understood. So the CAPM is the one that we focus on in the paper. And we have some comments about assumption setting. And probably the most interesting thing is that there's a bit of caution needs to be taken when parameterising it. So that two of the important parameters in CAPM are risk-free rate plus the equity risk premium, and there's some indirect evidence that those two are negative correlated. And the graph on the left shows some of that indirect evidence where we've got what is a negative correlation between spreads on BBB bonds and the yield on three-year government bonds. So you might be saying, what's that got to do with equity risk premiums? Well, the argument is if there's a negative correlation in the price for credit risk, there probably will be one in the price for equity risk as well. There's some other lines of evidence as well in the paper that we discuss as well. And with that, I might actually push on because I think we're running out of time. So I'll hand over to Tim, who will now talk about some practical examples.
Thanks. So here we looked at the application of both the internal rate of return and Myers-Cohen models to two lines of business, being CTP and domestic motor. We chose these to represent long-tail and short-tail business, respectively. We calibrated the premium rates such that they were broadly consistent with industry data at the time, and details of that can be seen in the first table there. The second table looks at the impact of using spot rates on key model outputs. So we've considered three scenarios here. One where we use a single discount rate, one where we have an upward sloping yield curve, and one where we have an inverted yield curve. When compared with the base scenario, the upward sloping yield curve produces a higher return on equity, and this is because you get lower returns in the short term, which are compensated by higher long-term returns, and the inverse holds for the inverted yield curve. This just illustrates the sort of impact that discount rate parameterisation can have on key model outputs such as return on equity. So here we were considering how important is the discount rate and how do variations in your assumption for the discount rate impact your return on equity, especially relative to other model inputs you might have. So you can see for CTP, unsurprisingly, given the length of time it takes for claims to be settled and paid out, the discount rate has a reasonable impact on the return on equity, perhaps not as high as something like the net claims cost, obviously, but it does have an impact of 1% to 2%. For motor, again, unsurprisingly, given the short duration of the claims, it has a far, it really doesn't have a big impact at all. This table here looks at the Myers-Cohen model, and it shows the implied profit margin in the CTP example. We tested a range of liability betas, risk-free rates, and equity risk premiums. Here, the liability beta that was required to produce the same premium profit margin as the base IRR model is minus 0.5. And although that it's often said that the liability beta should be zero due to the lack of correlation between claims cost and share market returns, that doesn't allow for the frictional cost that Peter mentioned, and so a loading up in the liability may be appropriate in this scenario. So now it's on to Hugh.
Good afternoon, everyone. So I'm the fourth stooge, and I just wanted to add my thanks to the Research Council to funding this project. I think they were a little bit excited when they saw a joint Taylor Fry Finity bid, because with Taylor Fry you get something technically rigorous, and with Finity something you might understand. They possibly underestimated the chance that you get the complete opposite. But we'll see. So I'm talking about the yield curve projection. So as Tim mentioned, the interest rates are moderately important, particularly for longer tail businesses. And the reason why they're of interest is because there is a time gap between when pricing is set quite often and when the premium is collected. And if the yield curve moves in between during that time period, you'll actually be running an interest rate risk. And so I've tried to illustrate that on the graph on the slide, and you can see that this is a company who has a one-year lag between their pricing exercise and their premium collection, and they're targeting a return on equity of 15%. And that actual blue line there is what their actual return on equity would be, simply due to that variability in interest rate yield curve evolution over that year gap. And you can see the return on equity does sort of bounce up and down by about 5%, so a moderate, not severe risk, but reasonable and worth thinking about. The other thing that's interesting about that, so I've designed the premium setting using the expectations hypothesis, and I'll talk a little bit more about that in a sec, but the average actually seems to lie a little bit below 15%. And that's reflecting the fact that the interest curve on average is upward sloping, so you sort of end up assuming slightly higher discount rates on average than you might actually see when it comes to collecting a premium. So you have this time gap. It is worth pointing out that if it's something that you're really worried about, it is possible to lock in today's yield curve. And the way you do that is by borrowing some money, investing it as you expect claims and expenses to arrive in Commonwealth securities or whatever else you want, and then you can repay that loan when you collect the premium. So it is possible to lock in. You pay a cost for that. So we've estimated that cost around 0.5% of premium for something like CTP, just by looking at the difference between borrowing rates and risk-free rates. You might be able to do cheaper again via derivatives, and that's something that we haven't been able to estimate as part of the paper. So it is possible to lock in a yield curve. And because of that, the expectations hypothesis is probably a good place to start for a lot of people, and certainly for a regulator, it's probably not a bad place to start. So the rest of this talk then is what to do when you aren't going to lock in the yield curve. So you want to know what the yield curve is going to look like in 6 months' time, in a year's time, and what you can say about it. So there are quite complex models about the term structure of interest rates. We mentioned a couple of them in the paper. They are quite hard to parameterise well, and they're probably a little bit over-engineered for the type of sort of applications we're talking about here. So we've sort of scaled our view back to simpler models and then looked at what we could do from there. So there are a couple of simple approaches that are quite common. One is what I call the expectations hypothesis, where you effectively look at the yield curve and sort of shift it to the left. And so you assume, for instance, that the six-year forward rate that you observe today will be the five-year forward rate that you observe in a year's time. And so that's basically what you can lock in, that expectations assumption, when you do hedging. Another simple assumption is what I refer to as the static yield curve assumption. So basically today's yield curve will look identical to what the yield curve will be in a year's time. And that's trying to reflect the fact that there are term premiums, so longer-term rates tend to have a higher term premium and a higher return compared to short-term rates. And so they're two simple assumptions, and so we've looked at them, and then we've also looked at potential improvements on both of those things. So here's a slide that sort of we put together comparing the performance of these two simple predictors, expectations and static curve. So there's a couple of things to say. Overall, they're very, very similar, and that's probably the thing I should stress from the outset. So in cases where you end up with a too high premium using one method, you will almost always end up with a too high premium using another method. However, the static curve assumption does have a couple of advantages in the some sort of limited testing we did. One of those relates to bias, that because interest rates tend to get a little bit higher as you move to the right of the yield curve, you get a little bit of a bias when using the expectations hypothesis and you're not hedging. The other seems to be sort of a shape persistency effect. So particularly if you've got an inverted or a very steep yield curve, that shape actually tends to persist a little bit longer than what you would expect from the expectations hypothesis. And because of that, you can actually end up a little bit ahead using a static curve assumption. So there's some sort of slight arguments for static, but again, this is in the context of them both behaving very, very similarly and not deviating too much from each other. So we did a little bit of work trying to figure out whether you could improve on either of these assumptions using what I dare say is a simple evolution of it. So you can see a formula on the top of that slide, top right, where we've tried to express our future prediction of the forward curve as a linear combination of two effects. So the first term there is beta times the expectations assumption, so what we would expect the forward rates to be based on the yield curve and the expectations assumption, and then another factor which is effectively a mean reversion factor that to stabilise the curve. And so our hypothesis was that this might actually improve yield curve projection, sort of using this linear combination of factors rather than straight static curve or straight expectations. One advantage of that formulation is it's fairly easy to estimate those betas directly from historical data. And so that's what we've done in the table. So for different delta, being the lag between pricing and premium collection, and for various terms, so when the cash flows are going to occur after premium collection, we've estimated the beta factors and got the table up there. So you can see the factors are varying from sort of very low at the bottom left to sort of quite high at the top of the table, and the level of confidence associated with those estimates vary quite a lot. So you get quite good estimates for short-term projections, so a quarter or half of a year, and the worst projections correspond to when you have to try and project what short rates are going to do over a long delta. And so they're the low values of beta that you can see at the low, bottom left of that table. So what I take away from that table is that the expectations hypothesis does have a lot of information in it, so it will actually tell you quite a lot about whether the yield curve is going to be in 6 months or a year's time. However, there is some information that it doesn't explain. So for the one-year projection, the betas lie between sort of 50 and 70%. So that remaining 30 to 50% then has to be explained by other things. And so our hypothesis is that you could sort of substitute in a mean reversion assumption and get a little bit better prediction. So hopefully that makes some sense. Our observation on the historical data series is that it did add a little bit of value. So when it came to estimating the error of the curve itself, so the shape of the curve, our formula reduced the error by about 20 to 30%, and it had a 65% win rate. So what I mean by that is if you were looking back with the benefit of hindsight, which of the two methods should you have used sort of our formula or the expectations hypothesis. And the formula wins 65% of the time in terms of being closer to the correct premium. So it's not a sort of a devastatingly better result. It's a little bit better result for a little bit extra complexity, I guess. The main thing that's going on here is that it's actually dampening some of the more extreme movements. So you can see the estimation of the error, the premium error over time is illustrated on the chart there, and it does spike at particular cases where the yield curve is moving up or down in sort of an unexpected and extreme way. And the mean reversion assumption actually adds a little bit of stabilisation to premium, so it doesn't get sort of swing around too much when the bond curve does vary. And I think that's probably why there's a little bit of value being added by that mean reversion assumption. So in terms of implications, what we're playing around with in terms of our assumption setting is probably varying something like a CT premium by 1% to 2%. And I've tried to illustrate that on the chart up there. The black line, supposing the expectations gives you a premium of 100. The formula is the orange line there, and that's how much you should vary your premium up or down relative to that 100 based on if you're using that formula rather than the expectations for sort of our hypothetical CTP premium that we're going to collect in a year's time. So at the moment, interestingly, you end up with a slightly lower premium, and that's because the mean reversion assumption is sort of pushing up the yield curve, which currently is a little bit low. And you can see also I've included the static assumption, which again sort of pushes results up and down by 1% to 2% over the past couple of years. So I think that's pretty much all I wanted to say. There's a couple of summary slides here that sort of echo the comments that Brett made at the start. So we've worked through some of the theoretical bases of pricing models and sort of talked about why they're more relevant, particularly for regulated classes. And I don't really want to repeat everything Brett said, but we've sort of looked at the literature, tried to summarise things quite well. The paper has quite a nice work example of how these pricing models work themselves out in practice, which I think is useful for people who want to think about this a little bit more. And then we've added a little bit about yield curve projection, and maybe you can do a little bit better than expectations if you're unwilling to hedge that risk. So thank you very much.
Many thanks, team. We don't have a lot of time for questions, but I'd love to have a comment or a question from the floor. Who would like to ask a question? Please say your name if you do. It's very simple, isn't it? Discount rates. Do you want to ask in the there for posterity's sake?
I was just wondering, it's a quick question. Do you think the reduction in interest rates over the last 20 years and the environment that's been occurring, it might have influenced the results that you're getting. Should we expect that coming off the low we're sitting on now, those sort of relationships to hold?
The devil's always in the detail. So I claimed a mean reversion assumption. What I actually meant was a slowly decreasing mean yield curve over time, reflecting the fact that yield curve has tended to drop since 1980, whatever. And that's a reality, that mean reversion assumption should be stable in the sense that you're trying to stabilise those movements. But your guess at what a mean curve today should look like relative to 10 years ago is as good as mine in some ways. So, I'll be very interested to see how yield curve develops over time. I might be the only person in the room to say that, but I haven't figured out how yields are going to go back up again after the latest sort of world quantitative easing effort.
I guess if we knew, we'd be fixed interest funds managers making a lot of money. Just going back to, I don't, David, if you can just flick back a couple of slides, a couple of tables that we had just to clarify. Go back one more, I think. Yeah, that one. That study covered the period June 97 to January 2008, and we deliberately chose that period so that the yields pretty much didn't trend over the period, which was why we got close to nil bias across all yield curve scenarios.
Do you have one more question or comment? If not, thank you very much, team, and I've got a prize for you afterwards. Cheers.